This evening, in the grand ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City, the City College Alumni Association held its annual dinner. At this time, CBS Radio brings you transcribed the address by the principal speaker at the dinner, the former President of the United States, Harry S. Truman. His subject, the history of hysteria. As we enter the ballroom, we hear a cheer to Mr. Truman.
Mr. President of the alumni, Mr. President of the College of the City of New York, and the ladies and gentlemen of this great audience, I sincerely wish that I could live up to that statement that your great historian has just made. I've tried to, but it would be an impossibility to do it. You know, I always enjoy coming to New York. As you know, part of my family insists on living here. I'm particularly glad on this occasion to be asked to attend this meeting of the alumni of the City College. City College is the oldest free municipal college in the United States. It helped to set the pattern for city colleges in many other parts of the country. Most of these colleges are supported by the taxpayers, and they are open to local students without reference to race, creed, color, or national origin. These colleges are part of a great tradition. They're dedicated to the freedom of the mind, to the concept that human reason shall be absolutely free to inquire into any branch of knowledge and absolutely responsible for its own decisions. These colleges are part of our great experiment in free education. They arise out of our belief that every member of our society should have an opportunity of obtaining an education and developing his natural gifts to the fullest extent of his ability. Our tradition combines freedom of thought and equality of opportunity for all. And out of this tradition come the great strength and energy of American life. The honor roll of the graduates of the City College of New York proves the truth of the proposition that freedom of thought is both the offspring of democracy and the servant of democracy. What freedom means to us is exemplified by the names of such graduates as Senator Robert Wagner in the field of government. And we have another Wagner coming on at the same time. Alfred Goldsmith in the field of science, and Morris Raphael Cohen and his distinguished son, Felix Cohen, in the realm of philosophy. Certainly it was a great loss to this institution and to the country when Felix Cohen went to the other world in his reward. I wish he could have stayed longer. I hope that City College will always live up to the standards of men like these. I hope it'll always stand as a citadel of freedom of thought and freedom of speech. In our troubled world today, this will not be an easy thing to do. Our generation has witnessed the most violent and the most relentless attacks on the freedom of the mind that have ever been launched in all the history of the world. A few years ago, the Nazis tried to destroy the intellectual and moral achievements of centuries under a wave of hate and prejudice. Today, the greatest foe of the free mind is communism. Soviet totalitarianism binds the mind of man with the chains of a police state, forbidding it to think about certain things at all, demanding that it reach predetermined conclusions about others, punishing with new refinements of brutality any deviation. The struggle against communism is more than a conflict between economic systems or ideals of government. Important as these things are, it is a struggle for the freedom of men's souls. Communism threatens us most of all through the military force and economic power of the Soviet state. As a political movement, communism has never gained much of a foothold in this country, and it is now thoroughly discredited and despised. All that keeps it alive are the resources and the persistence of the Soviet government. But as long as that government seeks to maintain a fifth column in this country, we should be constantly on the alert and vigilant as citizens to resist its efforts to infiltrate our society. In making this fight, we should be sure that we do not fall into the trap of adopting totalitarian tactics of the communists themselves. I shall say more about that in a moment, but first let me repeat what I've said many times before. The communist threat to freedom is the greatest in those countries where there are large communist parties, or in countries overshadowed by the communist armies, or in countries where poverty and injustice create fertile breeding grounds for revolution. The best way to resist communism is to have a strong national defense, to maintain strong alliances with other free nations, and to carry forward vigorous programs for raising the living standards of underprivileged areas. I am, I'll tell you, very skeptical about anti-communist crusaders who are willing to reduce our national defense or weaken our alliances with other free nations, or who try to sabotage point four. In fighting communist infiltration at home, we're faced with some very fundamental and very difficult problems. The nature of the communist conspiracy is such that in combating it, we have to scrutinize very closely the lives of many citizens. This is part of the struggle against espionage. But in resisting the enemy, we must not tear ourselves apart. Now that is what the demagogues among us would have us do. They're playing on our fears to further partisan political ends. They're playing on our fears to such a degree as to create distrust of some of our greatest institutions, our institutions of education and our institutions of religion. Our institutions of learning are one of our strongest defenses against communism because they are dedicated to the truth. So long as we have free discussion and free inquiry in our colleges and universities, we need not fear that they will fall under the spell of communism. Truth is the product of the clash of minds and ideas which is constantly going on in our institutions of learning. And communism cannot withstand the truth. We've always followed the policy in this country that the government, while it may support education, shall never control it. Neither the Congress, nor the federal government, nor the state government should put limitations on freedom of thought in our institutions of learning. The standards of a university or a college are the standards of intellectual integrity. They can be applied far better by the men responsible for the administration of our institutions of learning than by men in state legislatures or the Congress who have not devoted their lives to the special problems of education. Remember what Thomas Jefferson said. And I quote him, "I've sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility against every form of tyranny over the mind of man. Our educational institutions, like all our human institutions, are subject to human frailties and human errors. There's no mortal way to assure absolute perfection, but I'd submit that our universities are the best judges of the integrity of their own teachers, and it is far safer to let them police themselves than to subject them to political censorship. Friends, that same thing is true of religion. This wave of hysteria over communism has now reached the point where several legislators are undertaking to investigate the beliefs and opinions of clergymen. This is even more dangerous than the attack on education. I notice that these attacks have been leveled at some of the leaders of our great Protestant denominations and some of the leaders of our great Jewish congregations, even against those who are dead and unable to defend themselves or explain their actions. Now, we surely all know that our Protestant churches and our Jewish synagogues are among the strongest supporters of American principles and ideals. I do not believe that there is any distinction between any of our great religious groups in this country with respect to their adherence to the principles of our former government. I think it will be a sad day for religious tolerance in this country when anyone starts to draw lines between our great churches in this matter. We have a very great principle in this country, and it is written into the Constitution, that the Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. If Congress can make no laws prohibiting freedom of worship, it certainly is not entitled to investigate the beliefs of church groups or their leaders. Of course, if a clergyman is engaged in espionage or has violated the law in any way, he is subject to the law like any other citizen. But matters of belief and opinion present a very different question. Communism is the deadly foe of belief in God and of all organized religion. It is carefully written in the basic documents of communism that to be a communist, a man must be an atheist. Communism is just militant atheism. If a clergyman is an atheist, he's at odds with the vows he's taken, with the body of believers whom he serves, and with the God he professes. If such clergymen exist, their betrayal of religion is a matter for the churches to handle. Only the churches can decide whether a clergyman has been faithful to his vows of ordination or not. This is certainly not something for secular power, the power of the state, to decide. These are matters of conscience, and the Congress of the United States and its committees are not competent to judge them. The leaders of our churches have from time to time throughout our history taken stands on social issues. They've done this in response to the dictates of conscience. Wherever the moral law has appeared to them to be involved, many of them condemned slavery when it existed in this country. Many have condemned sweatshops, child labor, and the forcible denial of collective bargaining. We've lived to see these condemnations become the law of the land. We've moved forward along the road of moral progress under the spur of our great moral leaders in the churches. Of course, there are always differences of opinion in the churches themselves about how far church leaders should go in matters of this kind. Our churches have conservative wings and liberal wings. Some clergymen have been blind to social evils. Others have been misled or deceived as a result of their zeal for social justice. The government and all its branches should stay out of church affairs. Neither Congress, nor the executive, nor the courts should take it upon themselves to decide who should preach what in the pulpits. The churches and synagogues will take care of these matters themselves. I think they will come out with better answers than most of our other human institutions. These attacks which we are witnessing on our basic institutions, such as our departments of government, our institutions of higher learning, and our churches, have their parallel in waves of hysteria that have swept over the country in the past. One of the first of these was the agitation that culminated in the Alien and Sedition Laws. This occurred at the end of the 18th century when France, which had been our ally in the Revolution, seemed to have been transformed from a friend into a threatening enemy. At the same time, the majority of Americans here at home were rising up politically against the Federalist Party. Unscrupulous politicians tried to play on the fear of France in such a way as to injure the growing power of Jeffersonian democracy. As a result, the Alien and Sedition Laws were passed. The Sedition Law provided penalties of fine and imprisonment for people who indulged in criticism of the government of the United States. It was enforced exclusively against the editors and orators who supported Jefferson. We don't have many editors to do that to today, but... But this wave of hysteria was only temporary. The people were horrified by the use of the federal power to suppress the free expression of opinion. They moved to the ballot boxes and pitched the Federalists out of office. And the Federalist Party never recovered. I hope somebody will learn a lesson from this. The next wave of hysteria to be politically manipulated was the anti-Masonic movement. This occurred between the years of 1826 and 1840, when the Jacksonian democracy reached its peak. Jackson himself and many of his friends were Masons. Masonry had spread widely among the small businessmen and farmers of America in those days. Those who feared Jackson and what he represented picked the Masons as a subject of their attack. This wave of hysteria pictured the Masons as a secret conspiracy against the public good. It accused the Masons of all kinds of horrible crimes. Masonic lodges were broken up. Suspected Masons were boycotted and abused. The anti-Masons even formed a political party, for that had been their main objective all along, to get votes. But after a time, the people got tired of this nonsense, and the anti-Masonic movement disappeared. The next wave of intolerance came with the Know-Nothing movement. This was an anti-immigration agitation. It stirred up the most violent and dangerous of all emotions, that of religious prejudice. Catholic churches were destroyed, and Catholic priests were tarred and feathered. Seldom has there been such an ugly manifestation in American politics, for it was political. It took the shape of a political party and sought control of the national government. This dangerous conspiracy died away in the face of the real issues of the day, which were slavery and secession. At the polls in 1856, the Know-Nothing Party found itself deserted by the voters. The spirit of know-nothingism came to life again after World War I. Fear of foreigners and fear of organized labor were manipulated and brought together in the radical scare of the 20s, in the revival of the Ku Klux Klan. Here again, fear was stirred up for political purposes. Educational institutions were attacked. The Catholic religion and the Jewish religion were slandered and vilified. As a result, in many states, the Ku Klux Klan rose to considerable political importance. In Indiana, if you remember, they elected a governor who finally went to the penitentiary where he belonged. I had to oppose the Klan in my own state of Missouri. I was told that I would be subjected to physical violence if I spoke against the Klan. But I spoke against it anyway, and nothing happened. It just takes a little intestinal fortitude to put these merchants of fear and hate in their place. The Klan, like those other hate movements, was ultimately wiped out by the common sense of the American people. I sincerely hope, that our justified concern about communism in these days will not lead us further and further into a period of hysteria as in the past. In all I did when I was president to combat communism, I always sought to preserve the rights of the individual. I always tried to hold in check those ugly passions of intolerance and hate, which can be so easily manipulated by unscrupulous demagogues. For this, I was sometimes accused of being soft. This, of course, is ridiculous. I think the record will prove it. The great measures we took in foreign policy to check communist aggression abroad, and the measures we took at home to enforce the laws against espionage and sabotage and subversion, are evidence that I was moving relentlessly against all our enemies, both foreign and domestic. Now, I'm rather skeptical of fake crusaders who dig up and distort records of the past in order to take the attention of the people away from their political failures of the present day. Now, if our central government does not distinguish between the real dangers of communism and the hysterical fear of it, our national leaders do not stand firm against panic and against the invasion of individual freedoms, then we are indeed in for some bad times. Now, that brings me to my final point. In times such as these, when the national government is yielding to hysteria rather than resisting it, our colleges and universities have a very special obligation to maintain freedom of thought and inquiry. The precious freedoms for which your college stands, freedom of thought and freedom of the human spirit, are our greatest strength in the world struggle in which we are involved. We cannot win our goals by abandoning our values. I urge you to be alert and bold in preserving and protecting our democratic freedoms.
CBS Radio has brought you an address on civil rights by Harry S. Truman, former President of the United States. Mr. Truman was the principal speaker at the annual dinner of the City College Alumni Association, held in the Grand Ballroom of the Hotel Commodore in New York City.